Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as ever, is Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy.
James Jones.
Hi.
And John Lindemann.
Hello, party people.
All right, we're going to catch up on your listener mail a little bit later, but first up is new business. I've been playing mostly more Castlevania, but I did play a few odds and ends. I finished Zelda, which I talked about last week, Zelda 1.
Udo.
I was pretty close to finishing it already, but I guess I don't have much to say about it, but I do feel a kind of great sense of satisfaction because I realized that this is probably the first time I've ever beaten that game from start to finish. And it's partly because I never really owned it before the GameCube disc. I've never paid for Legend of Zelda. I got it free on GameCube, and then I got it for free.
He robbed Miyamoto for Legend of Zelda.
So you never owned the gold cartridge?
No, I played it a bunch. I borrowed it from people, and I played it at other people's houses.
John, I swear to God, if you insert gold cartridge innuendo into this podcast, I will kill you.
Yeah, so I'd played it ever since it was fairly new, you know, since I was a little kid, but I'd never actually owned it until recently. And like I said, I don't think I ever finished it on GameCube because it just wasn't a really good way to play it. But yeah, I finished it. I beat that shit. Nice. Second quest I might go into at some point. It just seems like the first quest, but more obtuse. So I don't know that that's really appealing to me, but I might check it out sometime or other. Probably won't get very far into it. I played a lot more Final Fantasy III/6, actually. I think I'm caught up with Greg at least, because I got Saban in the World of Ruin.
Oh, yeah, you passed me.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. And as soon as I get a chance, that's one that it will be a relatively slow burn for me. But a game like that, if I get a weekend where I'm not too busy with other stuff, I can easily play that game for like 10 hours and just get, and I'm, you know, pretty far into it already. So I'm sure I'll wrap it up here eventually. I'd like to finish it before Xenoblade gets here, but we'll see if that happens because Xenoblade is supposedly on the way.
You've got 3 weeks from the shipping date, man.
Yeah, I thought Inazuma showed up a bit quicker for you.
Inazuma was 2 weeks because it came from Guernsey.
Y'all know about Guernsey.
Guernsey, John.
You know how it's Guernsey is, I mean.
But Xenoblade came from, like, the Netherlands, so.
I have no idea where it's shipping from. I guess I'll find out when it gets here. And, you know, from the talkback thread, it looks like we convinced a few other people to get it. So maybe we'll be getting more listener mail about it. I know we've already had a few from people who imported it already, but I am pretty excited for Xenoblade, so it should be in my hands here pretty soon. But yeah, mainly I played more Castlevania Lords of Shadow, and I'm still enjoying that a lot. I'm pretty far into it now. I think I'm going to finish it this weekend. And it is a long game for certain. I've played quite a bit of it. And one thing I wanted to note that was kind of surprising, when the game it sets you up, it tells you early on, you have this kind of prologue where you go meet Pan, the demigod or whatever he is. You go out to this forest and you meet him, and he sort of gives you some guidance on what you need to do in your quest. And then from that point on, your quest is to defeat the three Lords of Shadow in order to bring your wife back from the dead. And even though there are three major bosses and you're clearly going to different regions, one's a Lycan, which is a werewolf, one's a vampire, and one's a... What's the other one, Greg?
I don't really want to... It gets complicated when you get to the third one.
Oh, okay. I'm just at the very beginning of that chapter. I haven't started it yet, so I don't actually know where I'm going for the third part. But one interesting thing I noticed is that the prologue takes maybe an hour to play through, maybe an hour and a half, whatever. It's not that long. And then the Lycan part is a few hours. You know, it's clearly a big chunk of the game. And then when you get to the second part with the vampire region, the vampire section of the game, I'm going through this, and I keep thinking that I must be at, like, the last level before the boss, and that happened 3 or 4 times, and each time I went through 3 or 4 more levels before I got to that point. It's like this chapter just goes on and on and on and on and on, and it turns out that the chunk of the game where you defeat the second Lord of Shadow is probably about twice as long as the chunk where you defeat the first Lord of Shadow. So it's kind of a strange pacing thing. So now I've beaten 2 of the bosses, so I'm, according to the quest and the story, I'm like 2/3 of the way through the game, but according to the progress meter, I'm probably well over 75% through the game. So I really don't know how it's going to end. It's going to be kind of interesting to see where it goes from here. But I'm liking it a lot. And the, as I hoped and expected, the platforming has gotten definitely more interesting. I've gotten new powers now that let me do some things I couldn't do before. And it's weird. There are elements of Uncharted where you're climbing a lot. You're climbing around. You're climbing up walls and you're grappling and you're kind of swinging around to different places. It's definitely not exactly what I expected when I got into this. It's a lot more involved platforming-wise than God of War or Devil May Cry, thank goodness. And there are some bosses you fight where it goes into weird Shadow of the Colossus territory. You're climbing around on giant enemies and you're using a shoulder button to hold on when they try to shake you off, and you have to climb up to certain places so you can stab the weak point, and then you move on to the next weak point, you do three or four of them, and the boss finally dies. And that's exactly how you play Shadow of the Colossus. Mm-hmm. So this game really does cobble together pieces from so many other successful series. But what I like is that it does all that well, and it wraps it all up in, because it is Castlevania, and it does a pretty good job of evoking that atmosphere and that gothic fantasy sense, you know, and that idea that you're kind of in a monster movie almost. Because it does a good job of all that stuff, it really does feel like it stakes out its own territory compared to all the games that it's clearly very much derivative of. So it's really good. It's by far the best 3D Castlevania game that I've played. I don't think there's any question about that. It's an excellent game. I do kind of wish I'd played it on PS3 instead of Xbox, because it comes on two discs on Xbox.
Oh, yes, yeah.
The game is linear, but if you want to, I mean, once you cross roughly the halfway point, you get on the second disc. If you want to go back to an earlier stage and try to find stuff that you missed or that you couldn't get at the time with your abilities, that means you have to get up and go change discs. And then when you get back to, when you get ready to move on with the story, that means you're going to have to put in the second disc all over again. So it's a minor inconvenience, but it's just one of those things where, everything else being equal, I probably should have played this on PlayStation, because I just wouldn't have to deal with that, you know, and everything else would be the same pretty much. One thing I've noticed is that the music doesn't stand out that much. I don't know if you had an issue with that, Greg.
I wouldn't say an issue, but I did remark upon it that, you know, the sort of music they went for was more of a cinematic score type.
Yeah.
And even in that sense, probably a bit understated.
Yeah,
it's good. I wouldn't quibble about the quality of it, but obviously its intent is very much less brimming with personality than some of the, yeah, you know, the very ostentatious kind of Castlevania music that we're kind of familiar with.
But is it actually like ambient though?
At times.
At times, yeah. It's just generally, it's a lot of orchestrated stuff. It sounds like a Lord of the Rings type of sound. You know, it sounds like an epic adventure soundtrack. So it's kind of muted, and it's underscoring the emotion of what's happening.
It's probably not as anthemic as something like Lord of the Rings. You know, I mean, Lord of the Rings has very many identifiable motifs for different characters and themes and all this kind of stuff. I wouldn't even say it goes that far. But it's still, the quality is good, so I don't really have a problem with it. You know, it's another one of those areas where, you know, maybe some Castlevania fans might think, well, it's not Castlevania enough for me.
Yeah, the whole game is kind of feels like that, though.
I think it's a detriment to the game. I really do. I don't think the music's bad, but if I don't notice it, then I don't really care how good or bad it is, right? So, and I'm not really noticing it that much as I play the game, because a lot of other things in the game are far more significant. And I think this is a franchise that where you would never consider calling the music understated. You know, even from the very first NES game is a very bombastic, unusual soundtrack to that game. And that kind of set the tone for the entire franchise. And, I don't mind them trying to do something different, but I think this is really kind of taking away one of the things that people do love about the series.
It's interesting because I think, you know, obviously there's a lot of talk about the game itself, you know, how Castlevania is it really? You know, is it not more akin to these games that you've talked about, like Shadow of the Colossus or God of War, and all, you know, that it's cribbing from? And of course, the music would have been a very easy way to sort of wrap it up in Castlevania clothing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And sort of endear it to fans without actually changing the substance of the game, but they didn't. And in a way, I kind of respect them for that. You know, they kind of just followed through on what they were doing rather than sort of token kind of fan service or anything. Well, there is one case of token fan service that you probably haven't got to yet involving music.
Yeah, maybe not. I did see Bloody Tears referred to in one of the write-ups for the stage intros, and The funny thing about this, every level starts with this narration from Patrick Stewart, who plays an important character in the story. He's a friend of yours. He's a fellow brother in the order that you're in, and he sort of meets up with you at various points on the quest. But he also narrates your story. So the load screens are just these pages of text that come down, and Patrick Stewart's narrating them. And it's so funny because some of these, I mean, I understand why they would choose him to do this. Because it is very, it's written in a sort of Shakespearean way. Not Shakespearean, but it's very grandiose the way it's written.
Theatrical.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's not a great story, but compared to the typical Castlevania story, it's fantastic. But, and the voice work is certainly a huge cut above what we're used to in this series. But sometimes the way he says things, the way he reads out some of these phrases, and it's really noticeable because you see the text on the screen as he reads it, you know. It's subtitled there for you basically, and sometimes the way he lets a sentence roll off his tongue seems kind of off-putting, and you think that they would have had him go back and redo it again. And I wonder if they just overwrote the script so much that they only had him in the studio for 1 or 2 days, and they just didn't have time to go back and do multiple takes on some of these.
Conceivable.
Yeah, I mean, he does it all very professionally. It's not like he's cracking up in the middle of a line or something.
So, yeah, they got Patrick Stewart, not extras castmate Ricky Gervais, who couldn't have got through a single line.
Yeah, but sometimes he reads something, and it's like, I don't think that's the way that was meant to be read. You know, like, it feels kind of strange. And I wonder if he was just so expensive as a voice actor that they just didn't have time to get another shot at it.
You've got a half hour and go.
If you like Patrick Stewart reading things, there is a lot of it in this game.
Yeah, he ends up doing a lot more, because of that, a lot more of the talking than anyone else. You know, you do have other name actors providing voices, but because he also, when his character is actually on screen, does a lot of sort of exposition and stuff as well, so it's like double duty.
Yeah, he's quite a notable centerpiece in the audio for this game. Anyway, I've talked about it enough. It's a cool game. I'll probably wrap it up this weekend. So, James, you got an update on Xenoblade?
Yes, I've played it more, and there are now more hours banked in it than there were last week, as one would imply. It's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 hours at this point. Maybe a little bit more than that.
Nice.
So what's happened as the game progresses is that the scope, necessarily for the confines of the story, starts to restrict down what you're doing in terms of the story mission. You could still leave and do whatever the hell you want in the world to these more intimate spaces, which means I spend more time getting lost and trying to figure out where the hell I'm going as opposed to an open field, which means I need to go over there. I'll just walk. So a lot more time has been spent in the last couple days just wandering around corridors trying to figure out where the hell I'm going. And that's been a rather unwelcome addition to the game. I do have one issue I wanted to raise about the game last week, and it slipped my mind at the time. And that is my biggest complaint with the game is the implementation of a jumping system. Now, I praise the jumping system in that I was able to jump off of a bridge and land in a river.
Yeah.
And therefore discover elements of the game. And many times in the game, I jump off a ledge simply to save myself time. Now, if you fall too far, you take damage. And if you fall way too far, you die, which in the in-game achievement system will earn you an achievement for jumping so far you die on impact. What I found is that the jumping itself is actually kind of crappy. In fact, anytime the game asks you to platform, which thankfully isn't super frequent, but does happen, it's unpleasant, just in the extreme, usually.
I was really surprised, actually. It finally arrived this week for me, and to discover that it actually had a jump button.
Yes.
And therefore, I was like, am I going to have to use this later? And I guess that's my answer.
There are a few moments where you do have to use it, and generally speaking, they're not good. I mean, they're never like, you know, Mario Galaxy style platforming. You never have to only step on the panels one time before they fall off into space. but there is a certain amount of jumping that can be frustrating, because a lot of times you're jumping across these platforms that are, you know, like a pipe sticking out of a wall, and you just slightly over jump it and you slide off and fall into oblivion.
Now, do you think this would be better if you had 3D?
You mean like on the 3DS? Yes.
Yes.
Yes, Miyamoto, I think this will be much better. So last week talking about this game, you were a Wada, and I am Miyamoto. Congratulations. Next week, I expect you to be Sakurai telling me I only need one control stick.
I'm still working on it.
I enjoy the game quite a bit, but like I said, the constriction of area into these smaller spaces, even though they're greatly different than the environments I've been in the previous elements of the game, they do sort of feel too tight, and oftentimes it's like, I need to get over there, but I can't just walk straight there. I have to figure out how the hell I need to get over there.
And so they're a bit maze-like, is that what's happened?
Well, not quite. It's usually like, I'm on one platform, and then there's this big fucking ravine, and then there's another platform over there. And I need to figure out what series of corridors will take me over to that other side. Now, the game still highlights where I need to go, but it doesn't help me get there. It just tells me, sure, like, straight. If I was a bird, yes, I could get over there quite quickly, but I'm not. So, in general, the game, I'm still very happy with the game, but there are certain things about it that 50 hours in start to become more irksome than they were 20 hours in. And in general, it's not that I don't like the game, well, this is going to sound bad, but I'm ready for it to wrap up. I feel like it's hit that point where I'm like, okay, game, we really need to get on with it.
Yeah.
We need to get this shit done.
Yeah, it's like games can certainly overstay their welcome, definitely.
It's not that I'm not still enjoying it. It's that the game stopped introducing new elements a while ago.
Yeah.
And now it's more like work.
So you're just kind of slogging through the story just to slog through the story.
Pretty much. And I'm still, you know, I still encounter areas that I go, this is really cool. But there's a certain point where, like, the game has essentially given you sensory overload, and the number of cool things it can show you, it starts to wear off.
Mm-hmm. Is this all on one disc?
Yes.
It is a dual-layer disc.
It is a dual-layer, yes.
What are the relatively few? I guess, what, Smash Brothers and Other M, I think, are two of the only ones. I mean,
yeah.
That is an issue, by the way. I know there are some people whose Wiis have problems with reading dual-layered DVDs for some reason. This happened with Other M, and apparently happened with Xenoblade as well. So if people import it and they have an issue with the disc reading, it could be that rather than like your homebrew didn't work or something. Bear that in mind if you've had problems with previous dual-layer discs.
Yeah, and the game's bosses get more and more insidious as they go on. And not just in terms of difficulty, but in terms of the ways you have to counteract them. So what had previously just been beat the ever-living hell out of enemies has now turned into a much more tactical experience, which I like, although it does make some of the boss battles infinitely more frustrating. There are a handful of boss battles where you have to be particularly strategic, including one where you have to approach him from an incredibly long distance and he can shoot you. So you have to continually move between points of cover when he's getting ready to fire. And, you know, your ability to see the future lets you know when it's coming. But your AI might be too dumb to get out of the way, which can get old.
So, I mean, I guess this is par for the course for RPGs, but is this going to create, for me, in the future, a lot of long boss fights where you kind of fight for quite a while, sort of waiting for this big kind of turning point that's gone wrong a couple of times before and trying to get it right this time?
To an extent. So what I've found is that, generally speaking, they're usually done in under 10 minutes. I've not had any that really slog on beyond that. But what tends to happen is you might hit it the first time and just get wrecked because you'll go in there going, I don't know what he's going to do. And then you find out he's got some attack that's like the mega rape cannon. But because of the checkpoint system, which I talked about last week, where these landmarks where you respawn with everyone you saw last, odds are you're probably going to respawn right next to the boss. So all you have to do is like walk three steps and you're back in the fight. And generally speaking, the rule of defeat the weaker enemies and then go after the boss works, but there are a handful of cases where that's not tenable, and you get stuck with these battles where you have to kind of figure out what you need to do. At times you'll tweak your party a little bit and get lucky and just blaze through him, but generally speaking, the actual victory fight never goes beyond 10 minutes, but I've had boss battles that go on for much longer than that, collectively.
Yeah, sure.
Some of them feel rewarding. Some of them, like that bastard who could shoot you from across the world, just feel irritating. And once you finally beat him, you're like, yeah, take that, bitch. And then you're like, I don't want to play anymore. Save. Quit. I'm tired. And, I mean, that's really what it comes down to. It's shorter play sessions now that it's reached this point where I'm just on the final approach to the final boss, and I'm ready to just be there.
Do you think you spent too much time sort of farting around in the early parts of the game?
See, I didn't really... I mean, with the exception of the 1 5-hour of just doing nothing, I didn't really spend... I mean, there is a ton of quests I still need to complete. And in fact, yesterday I went off and did a bunch of them just kind of for shits, just to get out of the stage I was in because it had become so oppressive an area that I just didn't want to be there anymore. Some of them, there are a handful that are incredibly involved, and there are a handful that are just super easy. What I found is that when I go back to areas now that I was afraid to explore early because the enemies off the trail were horrible, I'm finding these neat little side areas I hadn't found before, and that's a nice relief from the main plot of the gameplay. But deep down, I still just want to finish the story. Like, I just want it to be there. And it sort of has diminished a little bit. I feel like if I come back after I'm done, I'll enjoy this part a bit more.
Oh, okay. Well, hopefully they'll let you do that.
It does. But I believe it just drops you right for the final boss battle. Standard RPG convention.
All right. So, John, what have you been playing on Nintendo platforms?
Not a heck of a lot.
Nothing. Next question.
Well, this week I'm going to talk about not so much games, but rather services.
Oh, so you're not talking about Nintendo at all?
Yeah, a couple weeks ago, I actually tried out Gaikai. Just really on a lark, I was just kind of like, you know, like, there's a couple PC games coming up that I'm interested in, but of course my PC is a piece of crap. So I was like, you know, what about this whole streaming kind of thing? So I checked it out, and on their website, their kind of business model is they don't want to be a service. Like, there's also, like, their main competitor is OnLive, which is actually, like a game-playing service. You subscribe for $15 a month or something, and I think you can actually... I think they actually use their own browser kind of thing. Like, you can stream it on your PC or stream it on... like, you can actually get a piece of hardware, and I think... I guess if you have an HDTV, you can actually stream games onto your HDTV with their hardware. So OnLive is kind of like... It's more of a typical sort of subscription model. With Gaikai, it's... Their whole deal is they want you to be able to try games, and they're kind of acting like almost like a hub. So if you see a game on a website, you can embed their stuff on your website, play it on the website. It just launches. I think it supports Java and Flash. You know, it'll launch a little window, and you can play the game in there streamed. And then, you know, it's kind of like click-through buying, right? So I was like, all right, like, you know, my computer kind of sucks. So, you know, I figured, you know, let's just see how this actually runs with, you know, a couple of games. So I tried The Witcher and I tried Crysis 2. And actually, I was pretty impressed by how it runs. It actually runs really, really well. There's some lag kind of, but it's very much like, you know, if you subscribe to Comcast Cable or something like that and you know, do their on-demand streaming. It's very comparable to that. You know, maybe sometimes you get a little bit of artifacting, but I was actually really surprised. There's very little lag or anything like that. You'll get some kind of hitching in sound and hitching in the graphics and everything, but I don't know whether or not really this is the future kind of thing, because, you know, bandwidth is, you know, going forward, bandwidth is going to be a big deal. At least, you know, I wouldn't be surprised, especially in countries where you actually have to pay for your bandwidth and you just don't get, you know, you don't get to drink from the massive hose like you do in the US, even though you know, even though Comcast is like capped at 250 gigs. That's the thing. It's like that sounds like a lot, but when you're dealing with streamed content, and if this is the only way you play games, let's say, you're streaming a lot of content if you're playing games every day, right? So I don't know how far it's going to go, but I was actually really impressed by it. So, you know, if you want to play one of those games or at least try one of them out, definitely give it a try.
And was there a noticeable input lag, you know, like you move something on the mouse and then it seems like it takes a while for something to happen in the game?
No, see, I thought there would be, you know, even like, you know, first-person shooter. I mean, there really wasn't a lot of lag. The only place I saw it, like in Crysis 2, the only place where it was a little bit of lag, and I wouldn't even call it lag, but like when you turn left or right, it blurs, right? And that felt a little bit strange, like maybe a little bit behind, like when you turn left and right, but completely playable. I mean, I could play that game front to back with no problems whatsoever. I mean, you're playing it kind of in a little box, and then if you put it full screen, it doesn't look as good, of course, because it's just sort of, it's really meant to run in a certain size of browser.
Really? Oh, because OnLive is full screen.
Yeah.
So maybe that's a big difference there.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see. And I don't know, is it the future of consoles? I don't know. I don't really think we'll get away from actual physical media for a long, long time. Just because, like I said, you know, all these companies are worldwide companies like Nintendo, Sony, Microsoft, and they want to be able to sell stuff in all territories. And if they just go completely online, then they're not going to be able to do that in like third world countries and stuff like that, where, you know, you don't have these really high bandwidth limits.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the console model of buying a disc, however you buy it, and playing it on there, is actually a pretty good system if you think about it, because physical media has become so cheap. You know, you can put so much stuff onto a disc. Like with Blu-ray, a single disc, you can put incredible amount of content on it. That means that the developers, you know, you don't have to worry about stuff like bandwidth. And I feel like physical media is becoming cheaper faster than bandwidth is becoming fatter and more available.
Yeah, and because of that, I'm very, very skeptical of it. But the one thing I will say is very nice is being able to play one of these games, especially with, you know, the PC games. I mean, you're a lot of times it's, you know, you start playing the whole spec game, and you know every game that comes out, it's always like, oh, it requires better hardware and better hardware and better hardware, which is one of the reasons why so many people play consoles, is because you just remove yourself from that whole arms race. It is very nice being able to play like pretty much the best of the best that's out there at any given time without even have to worry, like, you don't have to worry about hardware. Because really, ultimately, I mean, whether you're playing on PC or console, all that stuff, like the hardware really doesn't matter. You just want to play the game, ultimately.
Yeah, well, in PC games, the user worries about hardware.
Yep.
And how the game's going to run on it. In a console, the developer worries about the hardware and how the game's going to run on it.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, you can run a game at as high as you want, you know, settings-wise, just because it's not running on your server. It's running on some server somewhere else, and they're just piping you the video.
Now, if people want to try Gaikai, is it free? I mean, where do you get it? Where do you use it?
Just go to their website. I mean, I don't know. What they're doing is they have, like, partnerships with various sites and publishers as well. So, in other words, you'll go to, I think, Eurogamer.net. They have some partnership. I don't think they have anything actually on their site, but if you go to like EA.com, I believe they have like links, like you can play their games using Gaikai's tech. And of course, on their own website, they have several games that you can try. I think you can try Crysis 2, Witcher 2, Mass Effect 2, a bunch of games.
I was really hoping I'd get a chance to go, and they're all Monkey Island.
They're all Flash games. Streamed directly to your desktop.
Well, it's spelled Gaikai, if you're interested in this service.
Japanese for open ocean, Johnny, just to educate you a little bit.
Oh, okay. Very nice. All right, Greg, wrap it up, please.
Yep. So I did get Xenoblade yesterday, actually. It was funny. We were talking last week, Johnny and myself, somewhat concerned about how long this restock was going to take, you know, that would have to go from Germany to here and then from here to America, sort of. But and then I woke up the next day to see they were preparing to ship it. So I'd be happy to finally get my hands on it. And I put in a few hours. I got into the Bionis leg bit, the huge open expanse that James talked a bit about last week. And so not very far, obviously. But I'm already getting the sense that some of the conveniences that James spoke about last week are going to be helpful to me, in the sense that if I'm setting aside the time to play it on the TV and all, I will play it for a while, but not that long. You know, definitely not James 5 hours, not really doing anything pursuant to the overarching goals of the game kind of thing. Yeah. So I think what this seems to do with the saving, with respawn points and all that, is strike a nice enough balance that I'll be able to play for a significant but not terribly long amount of time and feel like I can achieve something in that span of time that was worth setting it aside for. So I'm optimistic that I can get through it at a sustained, if not rapid, pace over the next several weeks, shall we say. But other than that, another thing I wanted to talk about was a PSN demo that I played for Blood Rain Betrayal, which is actually a way forward HD 2D side-scrolling game that people have speculated may have started life as a sort of pitch to Konami as a sort of Castlevania revival. We have no idea of knowing whether that's true, but of course WayForward did do Contra 4, so it's not the sort of thing that's in altogether out of their wheelhouse to kind of take on a beloved old-school Konami property. But it's ended up being a Blood Rain thing, and I played the demo, and immediately I got the sense that I will buy this eventually.
Really?
It's got good reviews. I mean, not universally adoring or anything. There seems to be some people that mainly have a problem with the difficulty, which is music to my ears, of course. But there was actually more, I think, more than one level in the demo, but I stopped playing after the first one because I thought, well, I'll save it for the show, as it were. I'll save it for the game when I pick it up later on. But, you know, it's way forward 2D stuff in HD, so as you might imagine, it looks very pretty. It's also fairly old school kind of 2D game mechanics that you can observe so far, but there's a bit more kind of combat to it. If you know, some more modern 2D side scrollers you might think of are DS, like the Spider-Man games or Hatsworth, you know, that have kind of a combat edge to their action that you wouldn't have had in, like, you know, 8-bit and 16-bit games. There's a bit of that going on because she does have a certain amount of, like, combos, and you've got this, like, health restoring move that she does where she bites the enemies and things. So, yeah, it seems like it's got, mechanically, it's got maybe a little more to it, but it's pretty old school in its ethos, as you might expect from Way Forward. So I'm very encouraged. It's probably not going to be utterly flawless or anything as a Castlevania type game, but there's not that many things of this sort out there, and I think it's going to scratch that itch. And also, of course, next week, at least in Europe, is Way Forward's Aliens Infestation for DS. Is coming out finally, / you know, it's weird, it feels sudden and kind of belated all at once, because of course it was kind of a bit of necromancy seemed to go on as it sort of came back from the dead. But I'm looking forward to playing that next week. I think there's been some reviews in the magazines over here, sounds very good. Apparently this kind of, you've got the Sulaco, the sort of big ship from Aliens, that's going to be like the sort of Metroidvania area, you know, where you're exploring it relatively freely. But then also you've got like linear kind of missions inset in the story as well. So it should be interesting kind of blend, another sort of cracking of that nut of having more traditional level designs nested in a non-linear structure.
Yeah, I'm excited for that, because 1UP did a really cool, like, really humongous graph a couple months ago for the Metroid anniversary, and they noted, I mean, they had this game on there even though it's not out yet, and they just kind of graphically showed that this is sort of coming full circle, because of course Metroid is heavily influenced by Alien and Aliens. So to have an Aliens game that's sort of based on Metroid is a really nice tribute, and also just a very natural, very good fit. So I think it's going to be, you know, Way Forward is a good studio. I like their art more than their gameplay in general, and I have played some games from them that I thought were pretty bad, like Sigma Star Saga. Really cool idea and a pretty lame production, unfortunately, in the end. But that was a long time ago. I think they've learned a lot since then. I thought Buena's Blah was really good. So I'm looking forward to this. I think this and Kirby's Mass Attack could be a really nice last hurrah for the DS.
Absolutely, yeah. Kirby Mass Attack actually is a bit later in Europe. I would like to get that straight away, but it's about a month later. But that's better than the Epic Yarn situation last year.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, you can import on the 2DS.
You can, but if it's going to be
the DSi, then you're fucked.
Well, yeah, sure. But I mean, also, the European version has the Happy Japanese box art.
It does. Versus 10 Angry Kirbys.
10 Angry Kirbys. There's a good social commentary movie waiting to be made.
There's your episode title.
Way Forward have become sort of shockingly prolific all of a sudden. You had the Mighty Milky Way earlier in the year. Shantae was not that far behind that. Obviously, Blood Rain that I just spoke about. Mighty Switch Force is coming up. And then Aliens Infestation, which maybe it shouldn't count because it was probably mostly made like a couple of years ago. But you know, it's still...
I think they also did... didn't they also do a Thor game for DS?
Oh, they did. That's right. That was sort of... It was a brawler kind of game. A lot of people had praise for the visuals of the bosses, but being a brawler was a bit repetitive and all that. But it seemed like it had some merit. I mean, they are knocking some stuff out here. And most of it seems like it's pretty good. Certainly what I've played so far, I approve wholeheartedly of. I'm not sure how soon I'll get Blood Rain. Maybe in a way, you know, the fact that I'll probably pick Aliens up straight away might mean that I end up playing that a bit later down the line. And of course with PSN there is the possibility of discounts, but I'll get it eventually.
So they made a competent Blood Rain game? Is that
yes.
is that the, yeah, that sounds impossible.
I've already raised the possibility that it was not always a Blood Rain game. So if that satisfies you,
I'm pretty sure the Blood Rain franchise instantly gives games a 6 or lower score.
No, Blood Rain is old enough now. I guess they made 2 of them, right?
They've made 2 movies. If that helps you.
They made 2 movies, I know. Yeah, but I think there were 2 games.
The first one has Ben Kingsley in it.
One of the most offensive movies ever made. So congratulations.
Yikes. Okay, so Greg, what's next on the list?
Yeah, one thing I did want to mention, just to kind of follow on a little bit from last week, but it's something we didn't really talk about, Star Fox 64 3D, the multiplayer game. So if you read reviews of Star Fox 64 3D, which wasn't especially necessary in my case, but I still did it, the paragraph that refers to the multiplayer functions of the game usually goes something along the lines of, well, it's pretty fun, but it's not online, and that's about it. Which is all true, I concur. And of course, it's rather sad that it lacks online. There was recently something, and I think it was in the official UK Nintendo magazine, that they were a bit more explicit about the fact, well, basically, it would have been too costly and taken too much time, so we didn't bother.
It would have diminished the single player experience. You know, for a game that's over 10 years old.
Yeah, all that is BS, because in the same interview, the producer says that, but we really spent a lot of time on the new multiplayer mode. It's like, yeah, if you took the time to make a completely brand new local multiplayer mode, then you could have taken the time to put it online.
Basically, what it amounts to is they couldn't be bothered.
Yeah.
Yes. I think that is the real answer.
That is the succinct way of putting it. But leaving that aside, I would like to actually, as most reviews don't, talk about the multiplayer as it is. So, first of all, the download play thing is there, and it is true to its word. They'd said this before it came out, that the first time you initiate download play with someone, it takes quite a while, and then every subsequent time, it's incredibly quick. Obviously, it must like install something, save a file of some sort to the other person's DS.
Yeah, no, well, you can do that now that everyone has storage built into their handheld.
Yeah, exactly. So that's good. Cool. In fact, it's mandatory that it's downloadable, even if you had someone who had a copy of the game. But that works fine, and the way you can have the option of having a couple of bots in there. So I've just played 2-player, and that's still fun, you know, because you've got these levels that they've built now are quite big. There's a certain amount of variety because you've got, you know, different planets or an asteroid field, or that, you know, there's a certain amount of variety there, and the verticality is very much greater than it was before in the multiplayer in Star Fox. So you do need those 4 ships to kind of populate it to make it a kind of dynamic and frenetic battle. So that works well enough. Of course, ideally you'd have, you know, 4-player. I don't know, you know, how often you're going to be coming across, you know, 3 friends with 3DSs. Of course, they don't need copies of the game, but still, just that at this point is a bit challenging. But 1 person, I think, is not all that much to ask, and it is fun that way, in my experience. And also, they have made some significant changes to the mechanics of the game to make it function better as this sort of deathmatch type of experience. So, first of all, you know, when you do the U-turn, you know, when you flip over and change directions, that actually occurs very much more quickly than it does in the 1-player game when you're on like all range mode or you're doing the dogfights. It's very slow in that, really. And in this, you could just do it, change direction much faster. So again, it lends itself to a more kind of frenetic kind of action. It also does some other things, like, for instance, you know, the barrel roll, of course, which could block incoming laser fire. Well, now that kind of exhausts your boost meter, so you can't spam it. And therefore, you can't just save yourself from being assaulted by constantly barrel rolling. There's a timing element to it. And then you have these Mario Kart-style power-ups as well, which definitely are pretty cool. Quite a variety to them. But my favorite by far is the, I think it's called the Transposer, which simply swaps places with like the nearest ship to you. So you could kind of lure them in. They think, oh, I've got the drop on them. You know, I'm kind of right on top of them, ready to blast them in the back. And then you just teleport to where they are and you blast them in the back. It's great. And also like the charge shot, you can't hold it indefinitely like you can in the 1-player game. So again, more of a timing element, more of a skill element to that in this sort of versus mode. So there's a lot of adroit
little changes they made to the formula, to the gameplay, to actually make it work better as a dogfight kind of mode. So it is a shame when you see that kind of care taken that it wasn't extended to the online, but it doesn't change the fact that it is fun if you get the chance to play it that way.
Yeah, this sounds good. I have no doubt. I mean, Q Games made Star Fox Command, and that game had online multiplayer, and it was really fun. It was kind of hard to get people online because the net code wasn't good, so you had people, you know, dropping out of matches before it was over and stuff like that. It was, you know, typical Nintendo online problems, but when it worked, it was really fun, and I played it a good bit back when that game came out. So it's just really strange to me that this game, which is, you know, basically their follow-up to the same franchise, it doesn't do that. Come on a more powerful system 5 years later, however long it's been.
Yeah, and it goes beyond that. I mean, also, I've talked before it came out that I was kind of hoping for online leaderboards for the score attack mode. You know, you've got a score attack mode now. It would seem wise to have something like that, and of course it doesn't. You know, it has no online component whatsoever. But yeah, even just something like Street Pass leaderboards, you know, if you Street Pass with someone who's also got the game, it just sort of propagates their scores into your tables, and, you know, you could ultimately build up quite a few people's scores being incorporated into yours. You know, they could have at least done that if you want to avoid any online aspect whatsoever, but still have, you know, and I think that would have been very good for Pilot Wings as well. But for whatever reason, that didn't really cross their minds. I mean, it certainly looks like Mario Kart 7 is going to bring the full range of online and Street Pass sort of features that you'd expect. It's just, especially just on the Street Pass level, you would have thought they could have had that ready to go. And it's a huge thrust of their overall approach with 3DS, is just more and more reasons to keep it with you, because it's not a phone. It's not actually that useful. So you're not necessarily going to take it with you everywhere you go. I would have thought that some of the earlier games might have been a bit stronger on that.
Yeah, well, there were a couple decent things to do with it right at launch, but then ever since then, nothing that's come out. I mean, Zelda didn't use it, and I don't think it's a natural fit for Zelda, but like you said, for Star Fox, it does make sense. And I was just thinking, you know, it's kind of too bad that Star Fox multiplayer, such that it has existed since 64 in 97, has always been the all-range mode, and that there's not a better way to do an on-rails, you know, classic Star Fox level with two players. And I thought, well, they do it in Sin and Punishment, and, you know, and as a co-op mode, or maybe even a competitive score mode where you're playing on the same level, so you're competing over enemies and stuff. I think that could be really fun, and especially a co-op mode in which your R-Wings could actually collide with each other and become damaged. So you had to talk to each other to work out, okay, we're going to have to get through this gate. You boost and go first, and I'll follow in behind you. And then when we catch up, we'll have to separate again so we don't run into each other. That would be really fun.
But if you play four players, somebody has to be slippy. And that pretty much ruins it.
This would be too chaotic for four players. But I think for two players, that could be really fun.
It sounds like it could be pretty chaotic for two people. I mean,
yeah.
Especially because they are spacecraft, whatever, you know, the flying around and stuff is kind of, I mean, it'd be more feasible instead of Punishment to have two on-screen characters that are not going to be like crashing into each other. But of course, they don't do that. They do just have the co-star style mode. Although the one thing I thought was a real drop the ball a bit with Sin and Punishment, because there's that, I've talked before about the Issa and Karchi mode, the unlockable mode, where you actually swap characters. And so, you know, change which special attacks you're using or what health bar you've got. But what they should have done with that is actually have it, when you swap characters, you swap which player is currently being the main player in Mario Kart Double Dash style thing. But they didn't do that. I thought that was a real missed opportunity. So you could, again, that's something you could do with Star Fox.
There's so many possibilities that aren't being explored. This series has so much potential, and they haven't really done anything new with it in quite a while, unfortunately. But we'll see. Maybe we'll get a new one on 3DS later on. Who knows? All right, well, it is time to wrap up new business, so we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we've got your listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. All right, first up this week, we've got our TGS, that's Tokyo Game Show 2011 3DS Impressions Avalanche from James Charlton, Danny Bivens, and Minoru, including impressions of Resident Evil Revelations, Metal Gear Solid 3D Snake Eater, Kingdom Hearts Double Drop something digital.
Stream Drop Distance.
Double Dash.
Yes, there's Final Fantasy Theatrhythm, and very much more, including apparently amazing impressions of Love Plus Plus. So you definitely want to go check that out at the TGS event page, which you can find right on the front, I believe, of the website.
Also from said event page, we have hands-on impressions of the Slide Pad expansion from Danny, with a large number of exclusive pictures on the layout of the device. And JC also shares his free gifts from the show in his blog called The Swag and Artwork of TGS 2011.
On the impression front, we have 3DS impressions from Michael, TYP Cole, who makes a cameo appearance, looking at Mighty Switch Force. And he says, it looks like this upcoming eShop game from WayForward will be a mighty good time.
Oh, dear.
And we also have a 3DS preview by Nate Andrews of the Pinball Hall of Fame, the Williams Collection. I happen to have this for Wii, one of my many Wii games that I've played exclusively and extensively.
I reviewed it. That's how long ago it came out.
Yeah, and actually, I bought it because of your review, Greg.
It's a good game. I assume it will do well on 3DS. We move on to a review by Jared of the WiiWare game Moto Heroes, or Moto Heroes, as I think John immortally coined it in a previous now play, in which the creators of Trials HD dare you to defy death in a dune buggy. And I would recommend that you check out the video review that's included in that article as well by Jared, a video master. And finally, we have a Mother 3 feature, chapter 1 of it, which is called A Letter to You, Honey, by Nate Andrews. This is a very personal retrospective of a game that he has a lot of passion for, which is, of course, the fan-translated sequel to Earthbound. And as we've covered on a previous episode of the show, it opens with a quite remarkable family tragedy.
Yes, indeed. Okay, well, that is just a taste of the fantastic original content you can find at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the show. It's time for listener mail. You can get your email read on the show by emailing rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We love to hear from people, and we try to get as many on the show as we can. The very first email this week is from Michael. And Michael writes, last week, Johnny made some big statements about what Monster Hunter 4 would mean for the 3DS going forward, not only in Japan, but in the West as well. I was wondering why Japanese publishers would be compelled to release their new post-Monster Hunter 4 content to a very small install base in the West by comparison. I'm reminded of all the Japanese PSP games we never got, as well as the fact that people keep talking about this growing so-called rift between the two regions. Now, before we address this, I want to read another email that we got from a different listener that ties into this and I think may set up the conversation even more. So this letter is from Hanabishi. As you guys pointed out, Monster Hunter and all of these other big games being on 3DS bodes well for Japanese developer support in general. 3DS has a fair few popular mainstream games coming for it already. We have Monster Hunter, Kingdom Hearts, Resident Evil, Theatrhythm, Dragon Quest, and obviously we'll start seeing Final Fantasy and more further down the line. It's safe to assume that most of these games will make it out of Japan since they are all popular internationally. This brings us to the subject of smaller developers. 3DS doesn't have a system in place for smaller Japanese developers and publishers to put out their games. Nintendo's real battle in this regard is with retail outlets like GameStop, which aren't very accommodating of more niche titles. Reserving shelf space for those is always an uphill battle and an expensive prospect for smaller to mid-sized Japanese publishers who publish their games overseas. In this regard, Vita has more to offer these publishers due to the fact that full games will be downloadable via the PlayStation Network. I'd say this is Vita's one true advantage over 3DS. What are your thoughts on this matter?
What to me, the games that the first letter is referencing, the games that we don't get, the PSP games we don't get in particular, are the kind of stuff that I mentioned 2 weeks ago when we had Kohler on the show, like the just the ridiculous bullshit companies like Nice America Publish.
Yeah, and I feel like they're real niche titles.
And Exceed puts out. I mean, Exceed announced two games in the last couple weeks that I'd never freaking heard of for the PSP. That seemed like the most niche thing I'd ever heard of until the other game got announced.
And the important point there is those games are coming to the West.
Yeah, but
just smaller publishers.
Yeah, they're coming in basically crazy small releases that get no PR besides the Exceed Twitter account, which, as amusing as it is, and you should follow it because it is amusing, there's not much to say there in terms of a PR budget.
And that's where, I guess, if they get a digital release, that's advantageous.
Well, it is, but my concern is that it could be, all right, this is a good game, but is anybody really going to buy it if they don't know about it? I mean, ultimately, you still have to promote these games, and even more so because you're not going to get, you know, it's not going to be you're just walking by and see it on a shelf. You have to browse through a shop to see these games.
True, but at least it's more, I mean, if the quantities are that limited, it's just, you know, I mean, it'd be difficult for people to get hold of, whereas
sure,
in this case, you know, you could, the point is you can take what would otherwise be a bigger risk if you say, well, we've got both the small number of physical copies to think about and the digital space as well. You're hedging a little bit, and it seems like you can get your money one of two ways. It is more likely that publishers would put things out in the West that otherwise might be, you know, a bit of a non-starter.
Yeah, I mean, you have something like the 999 syndrome, which is I bought the only copy in the city when I got mine, well in a month before I planned to play it, simply because it was a copy and it was there, and I was there at the same time, and I knew that I really only had one chance at that game.
So that could be a problem for 3DS, I think. I mean, that's a fair point.
Now, on the flip side, though, I'm not sure how many people actually would have. I mean, it is entirely plausible that I could have come back in 3 months and that copy of that game still been there. Because it is an inordinately niche title. And I think that it's an advantage, but keep in mind that PSP games have been downloadable for a while now. At least,
yeah, exactly. Well, that's what I think. That's the point I always make when Johnny says, "Oh, well, those games are coming out." Yeah, and they are available digitally as well. A lot
of
them. It's not as universal as it should be.
No, but I mean, a publisher who wants to publish niche games can make sure their games are available for download.
Yeah, and what Sony's saying on Vita is that everything will be available for download. So you really could buy a Vita and never buy a physical game unless you just want to.
Mm.
And I'm sure GameStop is loving that. But as a consumer, I'm very happy about it.
They'll do some kiosk deal or something, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, if you want the limited edition with the bonus with the cat helmet, you'll have to go to GameStop for it.
If you want the limited edition with physical presence...
I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, in general, in terms of this rift that you've got and how, you know, could it be that if there is a growing divide between these markets, that it does become more difficult for even games that we wouldn't consider to be as niche as, you know, something like James has discussed? Could it be that we see fewer games getting localized? I think that's not completely out of the question, because one of the things that we've seen, you know, with 3DS in Japan and DS before, they're willing to pay big prices for games over there, and they pay genre premiums. You know, something like Tales of the Abyss on 3DS is quite a bit more expensive to buy than Star Fox 64 3D over there, for instance, and all this kind of stuff. And the problem could be, you know, trying to sort of fit it over in the Western markets, you know, the $40 or, you know, over here, £30 or whatever. If that's the pricing structure that you've kind of boxed into, it might be even more difficult to sell some of these niche games unless it's going to be in super limited quantities. And then it raises the question of whether it's worth doing it at all. So, I mean, that's another thing about the Japanese market. I feel confident that the 3DS can be a success there because the Japanese market has proven that it can sustain, you know, that it can accept high prices for software, with portable especially, for years now, even though they had a sort of vibrant cell phone gaming scene way before we did.
Yeah.
They were kind of ahead of the curve on that in a lot of ways, and people have stopped buying portable games for big prices. But that's not proven here, and insofar as it isn't proven, it might make it more difficult for some of these Japanese games to come across.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking earlier today, I was actually driving and thinking about this topic. I wonder if people are listening to my comments last week week about Monster Hunter 4 and how it's such a good thing for 3DS and how it's going to bring all these other games along with it. And they're skeptical because Monster Hunter 3 Tri was on Wii. And it didn't exactly save the Wii. It certainly did a lot of good for the Wii, especially in Japan. But it didn't seem to spur a ton of new development for that system. And it didn't have crazy, crazy sales numbers either on Wii. I mean, it sold really well in Japan. But it wasn't like the most successful Wii game of all time. And I think the key difference there is it is a console game. And Monster Hunter started out as a console game. It was a PS2 game. And it never got really crazy big in Japan until it got to PSP. That was the dawn of the new age of the rule of Monster Hunter, mm-hmm. was when it hit PSP. And then they released more and more and more versions for PSP. So this is a really handheld-driven franchise. And what you saw in Japan is that there was a ton of PSP development. That, I mean, you've got even got developers, some developers had basically switched to DS, and then once Monster Hunter became big, they switched back to PSP and started doing most of their development on that system. You've also got developers who basically gave up consoles and put most of their development resources towards handhelds, primarily because of the success of Monster Hunter. So that's a very key difference, console versus handheld. The other thing is, yes, to some extent, the PSP was revived by the Monster Hunter economy that developed up around it. But that's not to say that PSP became like a really massive, massive success. You know, I mean, DS still did better.
What I would say to that is that a lot of the games that came out on the PSP, a lot of these games that were mentioned in the first letter, were games that would even be considered niche in Japan. And you could argue that companies were putting out games on the PSP to duck the major company competition on the DS to an extent. Because the DS became the purveyance of the major publishers. I mean, Square Enix, in terms of RPG makers, pretty much owned the DS for about a three-year stretch there for a while. If you wanted to make a dent on the portable RPG market, what better way than to just get away from them?
But you had companies like Konami doing a lot of Metal Gear stuff. On the PSP, you had Sega putting Valkyria Chronicles and, you know, various other major titles on the PSP. You know, I don't want to diminish that, but I also would like to point out that the PSP was already an old system by the time Monster Hunter became big in Japan.
Monster Hunter just made sure that it kept selling.
Right, exactly. So that system would have been tanking very quickly if not for Monster Hunter. Mm-hmm. And the result of that, the way it worked out is that the system carried on and was and actually became more successful than ever and had a much longer life than it would have otherwise. Now, the big difference here is that 3DS has a Monster Hunter, the Monster Hunter game. It's not even a spinoff. It is the sequel. Which is the first time they've done that, is release a new numbered sequel in the series on a handheld first. And they're doing that early in the system's life, sometime in 2012. So that means that it's going to coalesce the developer support onto this platform much earlier. And it's going to mean that 3DS will never have to have this kind of slow decay like PSP had before it was lifted back up. It's all going to happen early on. And 3DS already had really good third-party support, much better than the DS did early on. So this is just a huge, huge vote of confidence in it. And it's a really big deal.
I think that's the biggest thing is that, you know, there was a strong initial indication from, you know, a lot of third parties, certainly ones in Japan, pledging some big serious titles like Resident Evil, Metal Gear, etc. But there was a wobble when the 3DS obviously has had its problems. And you did need something to come in and shore it up. And, you know, this has done that. But how well it's going to do in the States is still going to affect how many of those 3DS games from Japan do come across. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, the kind of the localization calculus that publishers are going to make is going to be based on the install base in those territories. And so if, you know, it doesn't catch on in the same way in the West as it looks likely to do in Japan, we still could kind of go backwards. You know, I mean, that's one of the things with DS. It felt like we was getting more and more stuff from Japan than ever before. And some of that is just a kind of general direction of travel that, you know, localization is getting kind of better, more orderly and more pervasive, especially with the online media today. It's easier to promote things. People are more aware of stuff that's coming out of Japan, so it has more mindshare to begin with. But it is possible, if the 3DS is not the big success in the West, that we could kind of just go backwards on that purely as a numbers game. People look at it, so we can't sell enough copies to justify this, especially without the digital safety net.
Mm-hmm. You're right, but keep this in mind. Most of the handheld games sold in America, I'm not talking about iPhone stuff, I'm talking about DS, 3DS, PSP, Game Boy Advance. Most of the successful games and the vast majority of the titles sold are developed in Japan. The Western developers have not embraced handheld development very much at all. And
it's the purveyance of the licensed title.
Yeah, it's one reason why E3 tends to be not really great for handheld gaming, because E3 is dominated primarily by Western developers. And you go to EA's booth, and a year when they have Henry Hatsworth is a very special year indeed. Because usually they've got some kind of piece of shit Madden and some piece of shit Need for Speed. It's like token support. You know, Ubisoft never did anything really good for DS. They made some money on it, but they never really actually made anything good. So, I mean, you think about it, there really aren't any super breakout mega hits on DS or PSP that were developed in the West. I mean, there's certainly plenty of Western games on PSP. You've got the Ratchet and the Clank and the God of War and all that stuff, but none of that was like a really mega seller. Mm-hmm. And on DS, I think there's even less to point at.
Yep.
So the games that we're going to end up playing over the very long haul with 3DS and with Vita will come from Japan. So that's why Monster Hunter is such a big deal, because we have to have the Japanese developers on board. Because I got to tell you, man, I don't think Activision is going to be busting out a lot of really big deals on 3DS.
No, just Transformers licensed games and X-Men licensed games.
We might get a good Spider-Man, but it's just not, you're not going to see a bunch of really good original Western games on these platforms, because the culture isn't there. So we're really dependent on Japan to produce the awesome handheld games. And this means that they will be predominantly, I think, on 3DS rather than on Vita.
There's no denying how huge it is in that respect, definitely. But the point I'm making is that sounds great, but there could be a bit of a damper put on it from the point of view that, you know, look at the Edgeworth 2 situation. You know, Capcom very explicitly say, basically, you know, look at the numbers, it ain't worthwhile.
Yeah,
right.
And obviously that's at the point where the DS has a massive user base, but, you know, the market's deteriorated and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, if we come to 3DS, and, you know, big publisher like Capcom, they localize plenty of stuff, especially, you know, the international hits, you know, that kind of like Hanabishi points to, you know, Resident Evil, Street Fighter and all that. But lower down the line, what I'm worried about is that bar, instead of kind of being at Edgeworth 2, is like somewhere in the middle of the Ace Attorney games. That's kind of, you know, what I could see happening if the 3DS doesn't succeed in the West at the same level. And that would mean that the effect that we get of Monster Hunter 4 might be a bit more partial than we'd hope for.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be very interesting to see how these handhelds do, especially with the rise of smartphones, because this will be the first real set of new handhelds that have really been around when smartphones are just getting really, 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 really big.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I'm planning to get a smartphone here in the next month or so.
Yeah.
And I don't expect to be playing many video games on it. There's a few that I'm curious about and I'll try, but I don't think that's the kind of thing. That's not the reason I want it.
Well, the whole thing is, though, once you do have one, you kind of see, you're like, holy shit. I mean, all somebody has to do is add like a D-pad to this thing and four buttons, and this would pretty much be almost the perfect device.
Yeah, but nobody's doing that.
No, that's not saying nobody will, though. I mean, outside
of... Well, Xperia Play is there.
Sure.
But that's the thing, though.
That's a whole different monster, and it's called the Xperia Play, for God's sake.
That's the thing. Just nobody's done it yet.
Fair enough.
I mean, I think the big thing with smartphones as well is a sort of stock... You've got to look at this as a stock flow model situation in terms of people transitioning away from being regular buyers of portable software to just sort of subsisting on cheap, conveniently available games on their smartphone. You know, there's never a moment there necessarily where that person, you know, transitions from one group to the other by saying, oh, well, you know, I don't need this anymore. It just happens.
Yep.
You know, and they just find, well, I've got my phone with me all the time. I could just have stuff for cheap, and that's good enough. And they just fall out of the habit without any kind of major discretionary turning point of buying boxed products from games retailers and just depending on their phones. And then, of course, if the people who, as John said, that this is the difference now, the people who are kind of just coming into the portable market and they've already got their phone, do they have a certain level of satisfaction with that to even bother trying being a regular consumer of boxed portable software on 3DS or Vita or whatever? So you've got people coming out of the portable console scene, but then also fewer people going in. That's where it's going to get squeezed, yeah, quite likely.
Also, I mean, that's why I think part of the rise of Apple and, you know, iPhone gaming is the fact that, you know, the U.S. economy has tanked. It's even though the games aren't as good on the iPhone, people are like, well, you know, I can get Angry Birds or whatever, and that's really cheap.
Well, it's free. I mean, it is literally free. There's just ads in the corner now.
Yeah, well, I would just say that those kind of people who are so easily swayed by the availability and convenience and the simple charm of iOS games or whatever are 5 years ago, those may very well have been the people who bought Nintendo DS. But they're also the people who only bought one or two games, and some of those had Z's in the title. So I don't think that's the market who were buying the really good DS games or PSP games for that matter.
That's true, but the thing is, I think that market is shrinking.
It does hurt hardware sales. I don't think it really hurts software sales for the so-called AAA or whatever, the core market type handheld games being released.
That's what needs to endure, isn't it? For this business model that Nintendo has got right now to work with going to the higher price software, especially, you know, where it seems like it's more price sensitive in the States, those AAA games really become more important. They are now big central planks of the platform success.
It's all tie ratio. Yes. Now they're looking more for tie ratio than straight selling hardware. Much like, you know, Xbox 360. They don't really care so much how much hardware they sell, but they care about, oh, well, we're selling 8.9 games per console as opposed to Sony, who is selling 7.8.
Remember that DS didn't get really big in America until there were games at the $20 price point, like Brain Age. And a lot of other stuff, too, that came out around that time. So, you know, when DS first launched, Mario 64 DS cost $35, and yes, it didn't sell all that well.
For actually. Good damn reason.
Yeah, so you're not going to hit the mass market selling games for $35, $40.
Well, especially when they're 12 years old, Nintendo.
And I know people think that's a new thing, but it's not a new thing. You couldn't do it back then either.
Yeah.
So I think right now there's no price stratification on 3DS games. You've got, you know, Bit Trip Saga coming out for $40, and I don't think it's worth that. And, you know, I don't think Star Fox is worth $40, and I don't think most of the things coming out lately are worth $40.
Yeah, especially when you see console games drop to $40 within 2 weeks of their release.
Well, the economies are scale are a little bit different on that, and the physical media they're being printed on is a little different. So I don't know that you're going to see the price dropping happen quite so much in the portable space, but there will eventually be price drops on this stuff. And I would pick up Star Fox 64 for $20, maybe $25. So, you know, it just depends. But right now, you don't really see any kind of diversity on that front. And I think, if the 3DS is ever to become as mainstream as the DS was, it's going to have to be able to do that. So we'll have to see if it...
Yeah, I struggle to see whether it will happen. I sense something of a retrenchment from Nintendo.
Yeah, and if it doesn't happen, that's okay too. You know, we can still get a lot of amazing games out of Japan without there being a DS in every home or three.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they're playing on the defensive now rather than being, you know, aggressive in terms of I mean, they'll still say all the right things about, oh, we're reaching out to more people than ever and all that. But, I mean, just pricing software the way they have, it tells you a lot more about where they think their bread's going to be buttered, the way things are changing. Because don't forget, the barrier that it presents now, if you get fewer people coming in on an entry level to a portable system buying cheaper games, and Nintendo's talked about trying to do this and how effective they've ever been at it, but kind of graduating them upstream to the point where they're buying the more expensive games all the time as well, insofar as that's ever happened, it's definitely going to happen less with the proliferation of smartphones, because it's just more more hurdles to cross in terms of price barriers in people's minds.
Yeah.
So again, you know, you could say, oh, well, those aren't the people that would have been buying the kind of core titles and all that, but they might have become them in the future. And that's how that demographic gets replenished, is by people coming in, and then obviously people leave. And at the minute, it's kind of one-way traffic.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, keep in mind with the way the DS arc went, not to say that 3DS could even copy this, but the first initial boost was with the smaller games like Nintendogs and Brain Age. But later on, in the second half of the life cycle for that system, where it experienced the most success was people buying full-price games, what we might even consider core games like New Super Mario Bros. And Mario Kart DS, and then almost going down, taking a step down into a lot of cheaper licensed stuff. So for Christmas, mom and dad would buy their kid a DS and get a Mario game with it, or maybe even a Zelda game, you know, something that they recognize. But then as the year goes on and the kid wants different games, they go back and they just look for the cheapest thing they can get. So,
and then you get Rayman.
So it's an interesting thing. I don't necessarily believe that Nintendo needs to bridge people from cheaper, simpler games to more expensive, more complex games. I think they need to sell them the complex, expensive games that they already have been, and then keep them at that level and make them actually feel like they got their money's worth and that they need to get more and more and more of that kind of experience. And I don't necessarily think they did a great job of it on DS, because they sold a hell of a lot of Mario Kart, which is a great game for DS, and a lot of people, their second game was something that couldn't even hold a candle to it. You know, I think they can sell people a 3DS with Ocarina of Time, but then are they going to follow that up with Cubic Ninja? You know, and how do you prevent them from doing that?
Don't allow Cubic Ninja to be released. That's how you prevent that.
All right, James, you've got the next letter.
Rob from Ohio writes, presumably many, if not most of those in the U.S. who want Xenoblade Chronicles, especially with the constrained European stock, will be importing the game. As NOA previously mentioned, they will be monitoring game sales abroad before considering bringing it to America. Let's assume for a moment that sales are such that the game is released in the US, since most who wanted it will probably have already imported it. Not to mention that site director Neil Ronahan already predicted disappointing sales regardless. Where does that leave the likelihood of a similar future scenario? Behold the Xenoblade paradox. Importing the game leads to high sales abroad, coming to the US, few in the U.S. buy the game, future games not released in the U.S. Furthermore, not importing the game possibly leads to a lack of acceptable sales to bring the game to the U.S. Should people who really want this and other games brought to the U.S. hold off on the slim hopes they can buy it locally, at the risk of probably being disappointed? Or should people who want the game buy the game despite the future ramifications? In other words, is the here and now or the big picture more important?
Import the game if you want it.
Yeah, there's no reason not to import the game.
I think the chance of Xenoblade coming to America, regardless of European sales, is very slim at this point.
And it gets slimmer as days go by.
Well, and the problem is they can't release it this year because Zelda's in the way.
Well, they could have earlier.
But now they can't.
But now it is too late, obviously. So at the earliest, it would be next year. But it's not going to happen. I really don't believe Xenoblade or Last Story or Pandora's Tower will be coming to America. I think Nintendo of America has shown that they do not care about these games. And quite frankly, those of us who are importing this game are a blip on the radar. Okay, yeah. We're talking like in the single thousands of people who would go through the trouble and the expense to actually do this. So, and Nintendo doesn't know how many people are importing this game. They just know how many sell in Europe. If we, as importers, make up the bulk or even have any kind of significant impact on the game sales in Europe, then it's not selling well in Europe. If this game sells well in Europe, it sells well regardless of people importing, because there aren't that many of us doing it.
Now, the only scenario where this factors in is if they released a truly horrendously tiny number of copies. And that is pretty much the only scenario in which we could say that there's an influence in play. Now, we did, as the letter notes, see a supply constraint, and I don't know how much of that is related to import sales.
Yeah, but I don't think it is. I think it's related to great reviews and word of mouth.
I think it's more likely Nintendo of Europe expected softer sales than they got.
Yeah.
And I think at best, what this might be more inclined to cause is Nintendo of America to reconsider another game, The Last Story, perhaps. Not Xenoblade. Xenoblade for them is probably done.
And here's the other part. If Nintendo of America released Xenoblade and it didn't sell because 2,000 or 3,000 people who imported it didn't go out and double dip, then they probably shouldn't have released it in the first place.
Yep.
If that is a significant enough reduction on the U.S. sales, then Reggie was right, and they should never have done it to begin with. Because if they're going to release this game, then they're going to have to market it and do PR and get people interested who would never consider importing a game.
Yeah.
And if they can't do that, then they shouldn't bother. So I don't this whole idea of future ramifications or whatever, that it's just bullshit. It's like voting, it's like buying games that you don't want to show support for a publisher. Fuck that. If you want the game, buy it.
Well, and the thing is, Nintendo has already shown, Nintendo of America, they've already shown that they do not base anything that they do on public outcry. So to think that anything you do is going to make them suddenly change that in the future, you're wrong. It's not going to happen. They don't give a shit now. They're not going to give a shit 2 years from now.
No, I mean, remember, this is the company that when they seem to be caught on the back foot about the relative outcry regarding this, posted on their Facebook account, we'll have an announcement soon, only to announce they had no fucking announcement.
Yeah.
Days later. Yeah. I mean, they seemingly were lost at sea on this whole affair.
Yeah, if they do decide to release it in America, the onus is on Nintendo of America to market the game and make it a success. It's not on you, the consumer, the individual gamer who wanted to play the game.
Right.
You have no responsibility whether this game is released or not. The only responsibility you have is to yourself. If you want to play it, then go out and spend the money and import it. Because right now, that is your only option.
Yeah, Nintendo still gets your money.
Well, a different branch does, yeah. I mean,
They do care, though. Look, somebody on Twitter said, you know, I kind of said, take that, Reggie. I just imported my copy. And somebody on Twitter's like, Reggie doesn't care. He gets your money anyway. I said, if Reggie didn't care, he wouldn't region lock the system. They care, okay?
Yeah, Nintendo of America, Nintendo of Europe's probably thrilled Nintendo of America didn't release the game.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's just good publicity for them as much as anything.
Yeah, they win a couple of different ways, to be honest. I mean, they get to sort of assert that they're a player within the corporate structure as a whole, and they get some free sales out of it, basically.
Yeah.
And they get a ton of free PR because NOA...
Yeah, I'm sure it will engender a certain amount of goodwill.
Yeah.
To perhaps make up for some of past transgressions.
I mean, for them, you guys shouldn't release the last story. It really sucks. Don't release it.
Yeah, I mean, quite frankly, however many people do import the game, if it ends up being released in America later on, which again, I think is unlikely, Nintendo, it needs you to be an ambassador for this game. They need you to spread the word of mouth because you've actually played it, and you speak the same language as these other people who will now have the chance to play it.
Well, they speak the same language as
You're not a negative impact on this game, but regardless, you have no social responsibility for the success of this game if it is released. I'm not double dipping if they release it in America.
Hell no.
I've already spent my money on the game. I've played it. I'll be glad to tell you that you should play it, but I have no responsibility to Nintendo or to this game. I've already bought it. I've already played it.
I look at it this way. Nintendo of America had a chance to get my money for this game, and they didn't.
Yeah.
I was a customer. If you're not willing to sell me something, I'll go to someone who will.
You were a potential customer.
Well, no, I am a Nintendo customer. This is not a point of dispute. And those three games get mentioned a lot, but you also have a few other handful of games that NOE has done recently that Nintendo of America just took waivers on. In most cases, they weren't first party or first party funded, but still, the NOE just sort of said, don't really care. I mean, in the case of one that comes out next week, there's Soul to Robo, which Xseed's picked up the rights for. And as I joked recently that I was going to play three NOE localized RPGs in a month, and that just felt wrong. But but that's essentially what happened, or what will happen to me through the course of the next month, because you know, NOE put out three separate games that Nintendo of America said, no, we don't want. And I want to play those games, so I'm going to.
You should play them all in Italiano.
I'm not sure that Inazuma 11 would have much of an impact if I played it in Italian.
Yeah. All right. So John has the next letter.
All right. Philip in Winnipeg writes, I was listening to episode 259 of RFN when I realized something odd. During your discussion of Xenoblade Chronicles for Wii, Johnny mentioned that listeners should import the software, but under no circumstances should they pirate it. What I find odd and admittedly somewhat contradictory is that you guys will often advocate the purchase of used copies of games, yet seems so opposed to piracy. Let me explain. Recently, the Blockbuster video stores in Canada closed down, and I was able to purchase a copy of Castlevania Lords of Shadow for PS3 for only $10 during their closeout sale.
We're going full circle here.
Yep. As I purchased the game, I realized that as far as the publisher is concerned, my purchase of this used copy is just as destructive to them as utilizing a pirated copy of the game. From Konami's perspective, there's absolutely no economic difference. I recall that I recently read an interview with a game publisher in the British game magazine Edge, in which this very case was made. In it, the developer made the case that he felt that piracy wasn't the worst issue affecting game sales, rather, it was used games. After thinking about it for a while, I have to say, this makes a lot of sense. It does seem highly contradictory in my mind to ridicule those that pirate games on the one hand, then go out and buy used copies on the other. In a way, you could say that buying used games is even worse than pirating games.
Spoken like a true pirate.
Arrgh!
Because buying used games creates a market for companies such as GameStop, who themselves contribute nothing to the actual design of the product being purchased. On a side note, you could say that about literally any marketer of a product, but anyways...
Take that, Walmart. Assholes.
It creates an economic incentive for a business model that actually co-opts wealth from the party that gamers would want to support, the publisher, to an extra middleman, being GameStop. One could argue that if gamers simply pirated a game, as bad as it is to deprive the publisher of income, at least this illegitimate transfer of wealth from publisher to middleman is avoided.
Oh my God, this is the dumbest argument in the history of arguments.
Okay, I do have a correction. We have to defend our honor here, first off, because I don't think it's accurate to say that we often advocate the purchase of used copies of games.
That is the first thing that I was going to say. As the editor of this show, the voices of myself and my three colleagues here ring through my ears for hours on end, the same things repeated. I hear the same things over and over and over and over again for 3 years, and I have not heard anything vaguely approaching the frequent advocacy of used game purchasing.
No.
It's just not accurate that I could say that with some authority, given my position. So this question is somewhat based on a false premise.
The closest that's come is when I mentioned things like GameStop had a 2-for-1 sale and I got stacked on games.
Sure, and I bought Killer 7 used, but you can't buy that new. So
yeah, I mean,
it was the most convenient way to do it.
To an extent, you could argue that that was some level of advocacy, but really, I was just prefacing why I suddenly had three fucking games to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, the only used games, I've never bought a used game from GameStop ever, and the only used game that I've really bought would be one from off of eBay, like Johnny said, that I couldn't get anywhere else.
Exactly. I'm exactly the same way. You'll frequently hear myself and I think the rest of us talk about buying games at a discount, but in my case, that is strictly still new games. Mm. I don't really like the idea of buying things used, not because of any publisher revenue politics or anything, you know, just because I like the new condition. I've had some bad experiences with used games and I've had to buy it used because it's out of print, you can't get it anywhere else, or it's an import game, you can't get it new anymore, that sort of thing. You know, I haven't had the best of experiences with used products. So that part of the question in itself is kind of, you know, a bit invalid, but there's still some legitimate issues to talk through here.
Sure, and this is a popular argument. This has come up on Penny Arcade numerous times over the years, and so we're going to destroy this argument, but let's not make this a straw man, because it's not an ad hoc offensive on Philip here from Winnipeg, because I understand why someone would come to this conclusion, so we're going to respectfully explain to you why it's incorrect.
Well, I think the first and most fundamental point to make is that one thing is illegal, and that should matter to you, regardless of whether it sends money to this person or that person.
Well, legality is relative. I mean, renting games in Japan is illegal. It's legal in America. That doesn't mean it's morally right in one place and not in another.
Piracy is, I mean, to be fair, on the books, piracy is even illegal in fucking China. I mean,
piracy is de facto legal in Russia, and you almost can't buy legitimate games in Russia. I've tried.
No, but it's still technically not legal.
I mean, for me, you don't have to agree with every aspect of the law in your country to respect it, you know, and that
sure.
to be that should mean something straight off the bat. But furthermore, I mean, there was an interesting discussion of this that came out, I think, about a year ago. I think it was when someone over at THQ, a creative director over there, said, you know, much the same thing that Philip was pointing to that was said in Edge more recently, presumably, about used games being worse in a sense. And Chris Kohler wrote something in response to this on Wired. I think it was called GameStop, the Scapegoat, you know, something like that, if you want to look it up.
Yeah.
And basically what he was doing was not really advancing, you know, one perspective or the other, but to elaborate upon the more sort of complex interrelations there are between, you know, the purchases of used games and new games and how it all links up, and that it's not as simple as a lot of publishers like to sort of say when they talk about losing sales. I think there was a recent case with Heavy Rain, the people at Quantic Dream or whatever, that they said they lost 10 million euros.
Yeah, which is patently absurd.
We're not sure exactly how they got to that figure, but probably what they're saying is, we think they sold this many used copies. If they were new copies, we would have made all that money. Yeah. You know, and it's just...
Which is not one for one.
No, because it's cheaper. I mean, the barrier of entry is lower.
Exactly. I mean, that is part of it, that we have no knowledge that they would have been willing to buy new copies.
Well, this many houses were built. If people were more willing, we could have built that many skyscrapers. No, that's not how it works.
I mean, it's you know, without, you know, some sort of complex modeling of the elasticity of demand for games, we're not really going to get to the crux.
Which I doubt Quantic Dreams did, because they only bothered to program things crying.
We have no idea how many sales that actually cost.
Yeah.
But also, as Kohler goes through in this piece, there's a symbiotic relationship between the people that buy new games with the knowledge that if they're not that keen on a game, they play through it, they've had enough of it or whatever, they can trade it in, get a big part of their money back, and then use that money to fund the purchase of subsequent new games. And meanwhile, of course, that creates the supply line for people to buy the used games. So if every publisher in the market all of a sudden said, oh, okay, we're putting a stop to this shit, we're going to have a code, you know, like they do for like online stuff a lot, but just for the game, period, right? If they did that, you have no idea how many people would say, you know what, $60 is a lot to pay for a game. I don't think it's worth the risk when I don't have that safety net anymore of being able to trade it in and get my money back and then put that to future purchases of games. We have no idea how costly that would be to the games industry, because it's such a plank of it. These game retailers in Europe and in America, it's such a huge part of their business. It's clearly, obviously, therefore, a huge part of gamers' lives, a lot of gamers' lives, maybe not ours, you know, but there's definitely a section of gamers out there that's basically a big part of how they consume games. If you disrupt that, how positive, negative, we have no idea.
Well, yeah, like, I mean, what if you could only buy a new car? What if you could never trade your car in? People would buy a hell of a lot less cars, wouldn't they?
That's right. That's absolutely true.
Yeah, so here's a much more basic, like, kindergarten level of why piracy and used game sales are entirely morally inequivalent. When you buy a used copy of a game, there is a single copy that you have taken out of the market. It can only be played once at one given time. This is a physics thing. You know, you can only exist in a space in one place. You can't be in everywhere unless you want to get into multiverse bullshit.
I feel like we get into a Schrodinger's cat somewhere.
A little bit.
Where's Jerry O'Connell when you need him?
I say that
so often. When you buy a used game, a copy ceases to exist on the marketplace. It is now in the singular possession of one person. When you pirate a game, that is not the case. What you've done is you have created a duplicate of the original that can be duplicated as many times as it wants to be and played by as many units as people who are simply willing to go out and pursue a pirated version of this game.
Yeah, to put it a different way, if you lose a million sales because of used games, congratulations, because you just had a million seller.
Right.
If you lose a million sales because of piracy, congratulations, you sold at least one copy. You're probably going to be sleeping in the street tonight.
Well, and I mean, it completely blows away the basic supply and demand economic curve.
It gets rid of the concept of scarcity.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, piracy happens outside of an economy. So
right.
There are no economic laws that apply to piracy, especially digital piracy, because it's multiplicative.
In terms of used game sales, economics still apply. There's still a limited number of copies in the market. In terms of pirated games, there is an infinite number of copies in the market, limited only by the amount of hard drive space that exists in reality.
Yes.
Which is to say, there is a lot of fucking hard drive space in the world.
So that does a lot more to erode the value of the game, the perception of its value, than used games ever could. Yeah, because it creates the sense of, you know, people have a, you know, how they put a value on things. You know, scarcity, desirability, all those sorts of things is part of it. And so when piracy makes something ubiquitous, what Iwata says about, you know, like low-priced games destroying the value of games?
Non-priced games.
Piracy really destroys the value of it.
But, I mean, it goes beyond just the psychological impact being a pirate has on said plankwalker. I think the primary issue in play here is that it actually diminishes the value of each individual copy of the game.
But going on the sort of psychological behavioral thing again, another thing that was raised in Kohler's piece, which I think is very important, is again, go over to what I was talking about with 3DS, the stock flow sort of situation. With used game purchases and new game purchases, you've got this sort of symbiosis that occurs, but you've also got, surely, we must think, a transition between the two.
Right.
So, you know, it's not so different buying new games and buying used games at the same store that very often someone will be both categories at once. You know, one week buying something new, they'll be buying something used, and then maybe based on their own personal financial fortunes or going up and down or whatever, you know, they might transition from, oh, well, you know, I'll pay the extra for the new version because, yeah, I've got, you know, a good bit of money this month, and then, you know, times are tighter, they might scale it back and buy the used game. But, you know, those two kind of switch back and forth. If you've got someone who's just a pirate, there's no transferability really there.
Yeah, there's no pirate store that you go to, and
yeah, I mean they aren't even being a part of the community at that point.
Yeah, at least with used games, they're in the habit of buying games from a legitimate retailer, and then that habit has some sort of compatibility, some sort of transferability to buying the new variety.
I mean, they at least engage in the pipeline. The pirate is outside of it, like Johnny said.
I'm sure there are people who pirate stuff that they don't really give that much of a shit about, and then they buy stuff that's more important to them or something, but in general I would think there's a lot less sort of crossover for people who just play a lot of their stuff pirated than there is for somebody who plays a lot of their stuff used.
Yep.
I know very few people who only pirate a little bit of their content. I'm one of them. I pirated Mother 3 because
we did.
I couldn't import it. If I imported it, I wouldn't have been able to play it in English.
Nope.
And there was no other way. There's no way for me to buy it. I couldn't even buy it used because it was still been in Japanese. So I pirated that. But that's the only game I've pirated in 10 years at least.
Yeah.
So I think I'm a really rare exception.
The only games I've pirated were Japan-only games that have no chance of ever being released in the United States because they're too fucking weird. They're stuff that I would have given someone money for if there was a person to give money. But in the case of used game sales, there is a person to give money, and you did. You gave someone money. It happened. You expended some amount of value for this game.
And that person that you give money to also has a vested interest in actually selling new games that are coming out, and those sales support publishers.
And let's be clear. GameStop is, despite what... Well, first off, it's an edge, so they probably went and then gave Super Mario 3D Land a 4 out of 10 in the next page. But... those game stores like GameStop are important for the industry because there are not going to be niche titles sold at Walmart. Walmart doesn't sell the more out there games. They're too busy selling copies of Zumba Fitness.
Yeah, GameStop is still a boutique store. It is a specialty market.
GameStop serves a purpose in the industry in which you can buy things, like I mentioned earlier, $9.99, that you can't go get at Target. Although GameStop does make a lot of money off the used game sale industry, they do provide a lot of publishers with their only real outlet to sell a game in a physical brick-and-mortar location.
Yeah, I also think GameStop serves a purpose. And just like, you know, when I wanted a copy of Killer 7, I looked online first, couldn't really find a decent price on it. But because GameStop is a national chain and they have a lot of copies distributed across the nation, even though any given store may have between 0 and 2 copies of it lying around, they have so many in aggregate that the price they set for it is relatively low. In other words, they have a national standardized price regardless of the local availability, and they will ship copies around to different stores if necessary. So what I found is that in that case, they're acting almost like a permanent loan library, in that I can go and give them a nominal fee, $5, $6, for a game that hasn't been in print in half a decade. You know, and there is no cheaper way to buy a physical copy of that game. Now, I could probably find a server somewhere and download a copy of it and do a shitload of work on my GameCube to get it to run on it. But why would I go through all that trouble when I can drive a couple of miles and spend as much as a hamburger to buy a game that's otherwise quite difficult to find? I think that's a valuable service, you know, and that's a sense in which the sale of that used game, that didn't hurt Suda51. He doesn't give a shit. I think he loves that it enabled me to talk about this game on our podcast and get people interested in it.
Well, if he was not high enough to realize we were talking about his game, presumably. Yeah.
Well, I think there's, you know, one thing that you probably could say here that I think seems reasonable to me is that, you know, the kind of revenue split that you get, you know, with the used games, how much ends up kind of getting diverted to GameStop. I think you could say is it is inequitable. But the problem there, I think in large part now, is it's difficult for the publishers to kind of exert any pressure when you've got the kind of market power that you have with specialist game retailers, you know, both here and in the US, where basically one chain runs the whole thing. It's very difficult to kind of get leverage on them in this area to try and reach some sort of alternative arrangements where maybe you get a more equitable split of the revenue. So that is just an unfortunate kind of problem that's grown out of the, you know, the way that the market has kind of coalesced around these single retail chains.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see if a legitimate competitor to GameStop can break in and actually pick up some of the market share. I mean, what you've got is now like established big box stores as well as online retailers are trying to take some of that business away. But
yeah, and they do it with cross subsidy.
Right.
Yeah, and what GameStop does is not that special, and it's not, you know, what I mean, what they do isn't really any different than what other game stores did. GameStop just did more of it. And so eventually they were virtually the only game in town, but it doesn't have to be that way.
They didn't just do more of it though. They kind of developed a model that they made work for them, and big box retailers that don't sell used products, for them, that's going to be a difficult model to adapt to.
Yeah.
Because you have to develop supply chain acquisition in a completely different model than you're used to doing. GameStop has basically made this the core tenet of their business operations.
Yeah, you also have to retrain your customers to do a different kind of transaction in your store than they're used to.
Right.
You know, I go to Best Buy to look at TVs, not to sell them used games.
If people go to GameStop expecting to sell games.
Yeah.
And I would say they're almost kind of secure because nobody else can really come into the industry directly that specializes in that because they have a supply chain advantage. Online, it's kind of a pain to sell games online because you have to mail it.
Well, we've spent plenty of time talking about interesting video game economics here, but why don't we get into some more creative discussions? Greg has the next letter.
NBZ writes, "Hey guys, big fan of the show. You guys do a stellar job discussing the merits and flaws of any game, be they Nintendo made or otherwise. On that note, I would love to know what your opinions are on Minecraft. The game is still in beta." I usually say beta, actually, but because I've been brainwashed by Americans, basically. "But as you probably know, has picked up a lot of attention and success in the past year. I know it's not Nintendo related, but I would love to hear your guys' thoughts on the game and whether you've picked it up yet or not."
Am I the only one?
I have not played it.
Well, I have not played it.
I meant to, but I've never gotten around to it.
Okay. It was a popular topic on the newscast several months ago, so you might want to rummage through the archives over there and find that if you really want to hear a lot more talk on it. But I have Minecraft. It was given to me by a friend, and I very much appreciate that. I have not played it very much, precisely for the reason that was mentioned in the email here, because it is still in beta. It is not really a complete game, and playing it, I think that's quite evident. Not that it's buggy, it's just not really a game yet. That's the problem. It's a sandbox. It's emergent gameplay, and I'm not really a sandbox kind of guy. I mean, the people who love Minecraft and have played it for hundreds of hours are people who are going in there and like building sculptures and shit. And that is not really interesting to me. I want to be given a design that I can explore. I mean, I think that's a pretty consistent theme in everything I say about video games on the show. And right now, there's not really anything like that in Minecraft. They're working on it. There's an adventure mode that they're building, and I think there's some kind of rough version of it right now that was recently added. And I might check that out, but I'd really just kind of rather wait until it's finished and then play that. And I think I will like that based on what I've seen of it. I mean, it's first person. It has a really cool retro art style. It has some really strange mechanics where you can basically destroy any block in the game and then collect it and then rebuild things using all those parts that you built up. And I think if there's a purpose for doing that, if the game has a challenge it presents to me that I want to overcome, then I am happy to sit around and tinker and figure out how to build different things and how to make them out of different materials and how to upgrade them. I like all that stuff. But you take away the objective, and I'm not really interested anymore, even though you have all these great tools. And that's basically where I am with Minecraft right now. I think it's a game that I will like when it's finished, but as the beta experience, it's not really my thing. But it is for a lot of people. I mean, if you're really into Mario Paint, I think Minecraft is very much the modern version of that.
Well, it's like Legos, but your shit gets blown up every so often.
Yeah.
I mean, I just get a bigger kick out of seeing what people create in it rather than I probably would playing it.
There is a video that I'm not sure how to describe the person who made it, but they built an APU in Minecraft, which, if you're not clear on what that is, it's an additive processing unit. It's a component of a CPU. It's literally the part of your CPU that does addition. And he built it by basically just, all you have to do is put torches in there and you get your answer out of it. Which is cool, but it probably took him 3,000 hours to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, he had to build buses for it. I mean, it's absurd, but it's the most bizarrely hypnotic YouTube video I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, I've seen some pretty crazy roller coasters and stuff built in Minecraft, and that stuff is really neat to observe. But the actual act of creating something like that is not interesting to me at all.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, you don't have to actually play the game to experience it in that way. You can just watch a video of it. But I think people should check it out. And if you're like me, then you should, you know, it's cheaper to get in now. So it is kind of like a paid demo, but if you've seen videos of it and you think it might be cool, I think it will end up being sort of a Zelda kind of thing when it's finally finished. If you're interested in that, I think you can save a little money by buying it as a beta rather than wait for the final version. So, you know, you can consider that, but I'm just not the kind of person to get in there and just screw around with it. It's so hardcore. I mean, what little gameplay there actually is right now is almost like a roguelike. I mean, it's an extremely brutal adventure game kind of thing where just these insane random monsters come and blow you up and kill you over and over and over again, and it's not that much fun right now. But they're doing things like giving you a life meter and, you know, giving you more abilities and balancing and stuff like that. I'm sure it'll be really fun when they actually finish it. So I await the day. Now the next letter's from Wilson. Hey guys, love the show as always. With the recent release of the Ico and Shadow of the Colossus collection, it seems to have sparked a bit of debate. Some feel that the loose and sometimes frustrating controls add to the game as a whole, while others stand by the opinion that the bad controls are bad no matter what. Do you guys have any instances you can recall where less than ideal controls actually added to a game?
So let's we could push this back to a Nintendo game, which is the Resident Evil remake, which is just as terrible as the original game.
But it's pretty.
It doesn't matter if it's pretty if it plays like utter shit, and it does.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one in these select few borderline cases, I think. You know, I mean, a lot of the time you kind of feel like, oh, well, these controls are just bad or these controls are great. But there's a few cases I can think of where maybe not even in my own experience, but I know for other people, you know, it's like these controls are awkward. They're not necessarily bad, but, you know, they're different or this, that, and the other. The first thing I think of when you raise this issue is Super Ghouls and Ghosts, because a lot of people say that has terrible controls.
Yes.
And I wholeheartedly disagree.
I disagree as well.
Because I think the thing is about the controls is they're very restrictive, and that's very unusual for a sort of platform action game to have your controls where you do not control your jump in the air at all, apart from this double jump mechanic and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's very sort of unforgiving, seemingly, and contrarian. But I don't think that makes it bad.
It just makes it unfun.
Well, maybe so. To some people, they don't enjoy it. But
subjective.
For me, the key thing there that I would say to me makes it a fit is the level designs are very clearly, purposefully created to exploit those particular jumping mechanics. And it works.
Exploit is a good choice of word.
Now, you go to something like Little Big Planet. Now, I didn't have a big problem with Little Big Planet's weird floaty jumping. It didn't annoy me especially much. But what I would say is, and perhaps this is a byproduct of the nature of the game in general, you know, it was all about people making their own levels and all that, I did not get the sense, as I did in Super Ghouls and Ghosts, that this particular brand of jumping was some very specific design choice that fit like a glove around the kinds of level designs that were being prepared for the game. Mm-hmm. So in that case, it was much more of a head scratcher. Like, well, why are they the way they are?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the problem is when you do go off the beaten track of sort of what has become mainstream gaming handling in a particular genre, it is going to be by definition counterintuitive. And I think a lot of time people, gamers, need like a reason for that. And I don't think Little Big Planet really demonstrated that, because the level design is naturally all over the place. Now, I haven't played Shadow of the Colossus or Ico or anything like that, so I was wondering, you know, for those who have, where would you say it fits into that kind of spectrum I just outlined?
Well, with Shadow of the Colossus, I would say that whole game to me is kind of about slowly enjoying the ride. It's an action game, but it's not really a fast-paced action game to me. I don't know if that has more to do with kind of like the graphics engine itself, but that game always felt a little bit sluggish to me, so the controls really weren't too out of place for it. But some of my main complaint with that game is not so much the controls, but more the visual cues that you get in terms of, you know, like when you're climbing one of the bosses, like where can you grab onto, where you can't. That's what I had a problem with. And that kind of transfers through to the controls, but I didn't really have a problem with the controls themselves too much.
Yeah, I think one thing to note here is that good controls and bad controls are very subjective. And there are not games where I think the controls are bad and that actually makes the game better. There are games where I think the controls are bad, but the game is so good otherwise that I can tolerate the bad controls, although those are rare cases for me personally. But I think there are many games where, like, it's like Greg said, Super Ghouls and Ghosts is a great example that I cannot relate to whatsoever. But there are many games where the controls are just kind of weird. You know, like Katamari Damacy.
Mm-hmm.
Do I think that that game is better because of the way you control it? Yes. But I don't think the controls are bad. I think they're very responsive. They're just a little bit difficult to work with, because the idea is that you're rolling around this big ball that's very uneven, and you're rolling it over objects that are just kind of poking up out of the, you know, I mean, it's an awkward game. I mean, it's a game in which the movement should feel awkward, because that's what the game is about. And yeah. I think the way the game controls, although it is unusual and it takes a lot of getting used to, it's certainly responsive, and it does what you want it to do, basically. And I think the process of learning the controls in that game goes along with the process of learning how to play it, period. Of learning why it's designed the way it is, and of learning how to be successful at
it. I would say the same thing with Monster Hunter.
See, I think with Monster Hunter...
Monster Hunter's just bad, John.
No, I think it goes hand in hand, because I think with the whole thing with the camera... you know, because I thought at length, why in the hell did they design the camera this way? But the reason why they did is so that you can get different views on the action and where a monster is coming from.
Yeah, I think there are better ways that you could implement what you're talking about. And I think the other problem I have with Monster Hunter, the button assignments make no sense. And there's just it's a very...
avant-garde.
It's a very irrational control scheme, in my opinion, for Monster Hunter. I think in the case of Monster Hunter, there are numerous changes you can make that would make the game just plain easier and more enjoyable to play for a large number of people. For Katamari Damacy, I don't think that's true. You could control the Katamari on one joystick, but I don't think the game would be as much fun. And I don't actually think it would feel better. It would just feel different. It would feel more traditional, but not better. In the case of Monster Hunter, the kind of game that it is not that unusual. It's really similar to a lot of other games that have come before it, and they changed the controls for, I don't think, any particular reason except stubbornness. And they've kept them that way out of stubbornness and conservatism. I think you could easily improve the controls of Monster Hunter, and that game would not get worse, it would get better. But
so,
it's different for every case.
Here's a game that I'm going to surprise Johnny when I say it controls poorly. In Fragile Dreams, which I think has terrible fucking controls.
Oh, yes.
But in a weird way, it doesn't add to the game, but it does sort of reinforce the entire powerlessness of the main character. And while that may add to the ambiance a bit, I would much rather have some fucking decent controls.
Yeah, but it's a persistent theme with survival horror games of a, you know, that kind of type that goes back to like the original Resident Evil and all that, is that, well, you know, if you become too powerful by virtue of having these controls, does it take something out of the game?
Look at Eternal Darkness. The answer is no.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think that really lessened Eternal Darkness for me, having that relative freedom of control. So,
and that is a more combat heavy game. You're
meant
to feel it.
Eternal Darkness compensates by making it much more action. I mean, I would call Eternal Darkness more of just an action horror game than a survival horror game. Which sounds like I'm splitting hairs, but I am, so deal with it.
I want to return to Wilson's wording here. Wilson says, less than ideal controls. First off, I don't think that means anything, because I don't think there's any such thing as ideal controls.
That's a diplomatic way of saying bad controls.
Okay,
that's
fair
enough.
That's
a bit of old-fashioned British understatement I sense there.
Hey, exactly. I think Steel Battalion has ideal controls.
Okay, that's your opinion. But in terms of, so let's replace that with bad controls. Is there a time when I've thought bad controls actually added to a game? No, because if the controls add to the game, I don't think they're bad.
You still might not call them ideal, but you know, at least you would say they're complementary, and that yes. is the most important thing.
Yes, so by definition, my answer is no.
Yeah, that's, okay. that's perfect. If you've set out what the conditions are, and under those conditions, it's just...
I hate to be semantic, but... All right, so James has the next email.
So Nathan from Florida writes, when I got a Wii for Christmas over 2 years ago, I didn't know enough about the variety of games on it, so I was quickly disappointed in the lack of quality shooters on Wii. Sure, I bought Call of Duty games and played The Conduit, loved GoldenEye, but I, along now I see with many other fans, see that Nintendo is woefully lacking in FPSs. It may not matter to those who own more than one system, but I only have the Wii, so it matters to me. I did a bit of digging a while back and came across a great little trailer for High Voltage's The Grinder. I played Left 4 Dead and loved it, and thought that this would be Wii's answer. Sadly, this game seemed to have been stuck in development hell for the past 3 years. Now it seems to have a release date set sometime in October of this year, but I've heard nothing, and I've been looking. Do you think this game will ever be released? What if it was released 2 years ago, when it was supposed to be? Can you speculate on how it may have helped quell the complaints people had about the lack of shooters on Wii? Do you think at this point it would be wiser for them to make the jump to Wii U and make it a launch title?
It's a curious example. It's true what Nathan says there. I have seen it suggested, at least, that it was seeking an October launch date this year, even now, but without any publisher attached to it, which makes me somewhat skeptical that it's going to make that date.
Yeah, that's kind of tight.
They would certainly explain why there's no publicity surrounding it if there's no publisher to do it.
Johnny, I don't remember if you were there or not, but I've actually seen this game be played in person.
No, I wasn't there. I know what it was an E3 demo that we had a couple years ago.
E3 09, yes.
Yeah.
The game looked, it looked very, very, very early at that point. And I think they even acknowledged that it was incredibly early. So I think 2 years ago, they would have struggled to get that game out, even if they had a publisher at that moment.
Yeah, I mean, you saw it, obviously, being High Voltage, comes as no surprise. It was sort of trying to go for the same trick as what happened with the original Conduit.
Which they had literally just pulled at that point.
They put it out there, you know, in a pretty early state, just through IGN, like, this is a game we're making, we don't have a publisher, but we're working on it, and we're going to push, you know, the Wii's tech as far as we can go, we're going to do everything with pointer controls, and we want the market to know that this is out there, basically in a bid to get themselves a publishing deal, and eventually that happened with Sega, and so, yeah, they probably were showing Grindr in a very early state, but it didn't gain that same momentum.
No, it wasn't. I mean, remember, High Voltage makes their bread and butter doing licensed games. And I think it's more likely they basically said, well, this game isn't really going to get us there, so let's focus our efforts on Conduit 2.
Well, there's a few other things as well. Don't forget, at one point they announced that it was sort of going multi-platform, but sort of not, in that there would be Grindr on PS3, Xbox, but like as a top-down shooter. You know, like
yeah, it was
a sort of old school type game, and then
must have been as a download. That was the
yeah,
plan,
presumably,
right?
Yeah, and then still on Wii, you know, this sort of Left 4 Dead kind of thing. So it's been through a little bit of an odyssey, but it's difficult to see it coming back now. You know, with Wii software sales, especially in the Western markets where this is relevant, being so depressed now. You know, Nintendo themselves hardly seems willing, especially in America, as we've discussed, to wade into those waters with anything but the biggest hitters like, you know, Zelda or Kirby. It seems very unlikely that a publisher would pick this up at this point.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the possibility of moving on to Wii U, I would very much doubt that, because basically the game's whole hook, the whole point of it was that, well, we've got an engine on Wii that sort of lets us do things that mean this kind of game, you know, Left 4 Dead kind of game, we can make it up to some sort of acceptable standard on Wii. And so for people like Nathan who've just got a Wii, you know, even though you apparently, I assume you played Left 4 Dead on PC or something, you could play this kind of game because of, you know, our unique tech on your Wii, and that'll serve that market. On Wii U, that whole sort of weird low-tech advantage is completely irrelevant. You're
right.
Moving up to the ballpark with the HD guys, so it serves no purpose anymore.
Well, and to use a colloquialism, Ubisoft kind of stole their lunch. Well, the lunch they already stole themselves. With the second game they showed off at their Nintendo event at E3, which name is escaping me at the moment.
Oh, the Freaks game.
Yeah.
Killer Freaks from
outer space. Yeah, something like that. It seems to an extent reminiscent to what we're talking about here. I mean, there is a heavy multiplayer component and essentially what are a series of kill rooms. And that game, even though it was in an early version, looked a hell of a lot better than what, again, having seen someone play it, what I saw of the Grinder.
And it's on a different system too. To be
but
fair.
I mean, yeah. No, I mean, even on different systems, it looked like it was much better developed conceptually.
Yeah, so I think the Grinder might come back. It might show up eventually. I don't know on what platform or in what form. Maybe it'll just be the top-down shooter thing they can do as a download game on the HD systems or whatever. I don't really care, but I think with Conduit 2, what you saw is that High Voltage is in desperate need of better producers for their games. They have really good programmers and maybe some good artists, but I don't know that they really know how to put together a really solid package overall. So I don't really care that much whether they continue making these kinds of games on Nintendo platforms. But, you know, the other thing is Left 4 Dead is an online game. Do you really want to play that on the Wii? It would be nice if we could, and if we could be assured that it would be a good experience, but the Conduit and Conduit 2 certainly do not indicate to me that High Voltage...
You lose! What?
Yeah, so I just don't...
I strongly advise going back to when John, Johnny, and I talked about playing that game online.
Oh, you remind us of it frequently, James. I can almost picture... I almost feel like I was there too, although I most assuredly was not. I'm the only one of us who did not have the Conduit. I mean, in terms of the other part of Nathan's question as to what sort of difference could this have made if it had been released earlier... I don't think it could have made too much of a difference, really.
In 2009? Too late.
Yeah, exactly. I think if there's any argument to be made that a shooter could have come out on Wii and sort of created a more vibrant shooter scene, it would have had to be probably before Conduit came out, even. You know, I mean, if you'd had a game of the caliber of GoldenEye coming out in 2007.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, it still, let's just put it in perspective, it's probably not going to be anywhere near on the scale of the big shooter scene on the HD consoles, but it could have been, I think, significantly bigger than it ultimately was. Mm. But that's the problem. I think by the time you got something of the quality of GoldenEye coming along, that ship had sailed to a pretty big extent. Obviously, it still seems like it did okay on Wii. It still seems like it did pretty well. Most people who played it really enjoyed it, and then they're doing it digitally, you know, with the HD consoles and stuff. But I think the Grinder couldn't have changed that path.
I would say keep in mind that the Conduit didn't really alter the fortunes of the Wii, and it was released as a response, by their own admission, to the lack of shooters on the Wii.
In other words, it was too little, too late, And the problem was already established by that point.
Yeah, exactly. Just the way that Conduit itself was framed was sort of proof that the malaise had already set in.
Right.
Yeah, and Grindr is not drastically different in concept than the Conduit in terms of the kind of game it is. So if the Conduit couldn't do it, then the Grindr wouldn't have done it either.
Yeah.
So Nathan, if you only have a Wii and you're not in the market to buy another system to expand the possibilities, I think we can probably suggest a few other first-person shooter-style games that maybe you haven't played yet. Of course, Modern Warfare 3 is coming out this fall, so you can check that out. I suspect it'll be a pretty good version based on what they've done recently with the series on Wii. But Metroid Prime 3 is basically a first-person shooter, and if you haven't played that yet, absolutely. I mean, it's an old game. It's from 07, but it's totally worth going back to and checking out. It's not exactly like a first-person shooter, but I think the shooting in that game is as good or better than anything in Conduit 2, for instance, and that the structure of the game is far, far better in general anyway. The presentation's better. Everything about it's better. So definitely go check that out. And then Red Steel 2. Again, it's not a straight first-person shooter, but it is a first-person game. It controls the same way. There is shooting in it as well as swordplay. It's a very good game. You know, I have issues with it, but all these guys have played it and they like it, so you should check that out as well.
Yeah, Black Ops is pretty good too.
There you go. So you still have other options, but the first-person shooter situation is not going to get much better than it is right now on Wii. So,
yeah.
You know, if you really want lots more games like that, go get an Xbox or a PlayStation.
I mean, at this point, you're pretty much looking at Black Ops and GoldenEye 007 on Wii. That's about it.
Golden Blops.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap up the show. That's the last listener mail. So thanks to everybody who wrote in. We had some really good emails this week, and I hope you enjoyed our discussions predicated upon those. And we'll get back to listener mail very soon, maybe next week, maybe in 2 weeks. I don't know. But we always love getting into the mailbag. So you can send your letter to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and I implore you to do so, please. We really would like to hear from everyone. So let's get a few plugs in. We've got episode 5 of the Famicast is probably already downloaded to your system. If you don't subscribe, then number one, you should subscribe, and number two, you can go back and download it from the website, and you should do that. I think the guys in Japan ended up interviewing Billy Berkhammer on the floor of Tokyo Game Show, so you can go hear more of Billy as well. There's a new episode of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition where TYP brings on Dan Koopman. They play some really good games. I don't want to spoil one yet since the show just came out, but maybe next week we'll spoil a game if you haven't heard it by then. Anyway, it's a great episode. Definitely go check that out. Actually, one of Greg's leftover selections made it onto the show.
Ooh, intrigue.
So another thing, this is happening off the site, but I did want to plug my music podcast. It's called Discover Music Project. It's over at crosstalk.com. And if you've never listened to this before, please give it a shot. We're just celebrating the 1 year anniversary of Discover Music Project. I'm very, very proud of the show. I've had a lot of my friends on there. John's been on, and he's mm-hmm. going to come back, right?
Yeah, darn right.
And eventually, I might even get Greg and James on there. I hope so. So a lot of people you know, a lot of people you don't know, a lot of bands you've heard of, maybe a few that you have not. But the idea is that you go listen to some music. It won't hurt you, and you might just like it. So I would really encourage you to go check it out. It's a really fun show and educational, too. And then finally, we are gearing up for the next round of Retroactive. But we're not really sure what we want to include in the poll here. What's the theme? What are the games that we want to stick in there? So you can help us out. Either shoot us an email, a tweet, whatever, post on the Facebook page, or you can go to NWR and click on forums and then podcast discussion, and you'll see a forum thread there called Retroactive Nominations. And I would really appreciate people giving us a few ideas, and that will help us fill up the roster, and then we'll have a vote, and we'll move on with the next Retroactive. So please get involved, and we'll make it a really good feature. All right, well, that's the end of the episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next time on Radio Free Nintendo.
Peace.
All right, man. Well, I think are you done?
Well, just Crysis 2.
Oh yeah.
The new Crysis thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's a first-person shooter. New York is destroyed. You're the last hope of humanity. Yada yada yada.
Look who's Crysis now.
It's a really good-looking game. The Crysis game. Hey-o.
Is that the one with the sperm and the... Oh.
Didn't they actually... Didn't she do, like, a spread in Playboy, like the Blood Rain character? Didn't they have, like, some... The girls
that compete?
Yeah, they're classic.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a classy establishment there working in the Blood Rain franchise.
But the last Blood Rain game, I think, was for Xbox One, you know, and PS2.
No, I think there's been one since then.
It feels like it's been a long time since the series was active, so it's...
The last Blood Rain game, I mean...
The last Blood Rain game is In Captivity. The galaxy is at peace.
Oh...